Accession number 24539, Reel 2.
No, but marvellous they were. No wonder they could have stayed there till now, really. And a lot of got youngsters, they got, well, I was only young myself, I know, but they'd only just joined up, a lot of them, you know. I mean, on one occasion, we were at one place, and they brought a lot of the young prisoners in. They were only youngsters, half-starved, you know, and we'd just been into the local Salvation Army place, or the Natters, and we'd been born, and we gave them chocolate each, you know, poor devils, and had a meal for weeks of. He couldn't have lasted much longer in any case. Otherwise, life wasn't all that interesting. You thought about the night before when you were told we were going up to Ypres, or up, they say Ypres, going towards Ypres, you know, tomorrow, so-and-so-and-so-and-so. You're just going to wonder who's coming back and who's not. That's what it amounted to towards the end.
Did you lose any close friends?
Pardon?
Did you lose any close friends?
Yes, I lost my best pal. As I say, at first, when they bombarded us after the engineers, and we were told to, I was on an unpaid last call, same as he was. And we were told to, they'd knocked the front of the parapet down, you see, with their shells, with one shell, they knocked it down. And we were making the troops, chaps, if they wanted to pass, to go on their hands and knees. And my pal there, I don't know, he stood next to me only a few yards from me, and he just happened to stand up. And there was a sniper. Somebody said there was a small tree. As one of the our people didn't knock it down, we often used to talk about it. A small tree between us and the Jerry line, and this they must have been the sniper there, because he, my pal, got must have just stood up for a second, and this sniper got him. You know, I never went to. See his mother when I was got my leave, and I couldn't bear to go and see him because she thought so much of him, you know. I was afraid to upset them so much. Ronnie, yes.
Was he killed instantly?
Oh, yes. And he got hit with a dum-dum bullet right in the forehead, you know, split his head.
That's
wrong, yes.
Did you have to bury him?
I had to take the officers, said, you better take all his belongings, Hill, and and then wrap them all up and we'll send them home. So I took all his belongings out of his coat and then pulled him on one side. And the ambulance men, used to come up and then piss them away, you see, if it did, when it got a bit darker. But, few of them, I wonder, Pally in the Richmond, but he was my school pal as well.
How did you feel at the time? Were you very upset? Or?
Oh, yes, not the stuff in the, well, didn't knock the stuff in hell, but you'd wonder whether it's going to happen to you next, sort of thing, you know, and you were glad.
What was his name?
Ronnie Knight. Ronnie Knight, his name was. And, we were quite close friends and knew the family very well, but I didn't go, not, and I made inquiries sometime after, just after Oversley Mob, because she'd set up a shrine in the house, in the room, you know, in the lounge for him, you know. I couldn't bear to go and see him. I saw his brother, somebody, and I explained to him what had happened and everything. But, I don't know. It was futile. Same as the Second World War, of course. And they worked on a different project. there were more open, more travel, more movement in the Second World War. We were just trench life. That was all it was. Jerry got so far and he intended to stay there unless he was pushed back. And well, we, of course, we stayed where we were. We intended to move sometime or other. And so it's, and we had, I don't think we had the right generals either. Plummer, he was the Third Army man. I saw him once, I think, when we came out to the trenches. We never saw him. Haig and French, and of course French got disposed and Haig took his place. But they never come near the blooming trenches. They never saw them. As I say, when I went down with the other chaps, when we formed this new part of the business for taking the films, we went down to Boulogne-sur-Mer. The headquarters was just more or less in Boulogne. We were just on the outskirts. They were dressed up as they were going on parade at home. Or scarf parade, something like that. They didn't know there was a war on. We had, it was there 5 weeks. We had a really good time, you know. Best of everything. Nice and clean. And But apart from that, they didn't know. And he used the troops as gun fodder, that's all.
Did you think you would survive at the time?
A funny thing. I always thought I'd come through all right. As I say, funny thing, I wasn't afraid of a bullet. I don't know why, you know, it's just one of those things. And I thought I'd come through it all right. Now, my pal said he'd never come through. He got it into his head that he wouldn't survive. I don't know why, but unfortunately it just happened. But I thought I'd come through or somehow or the other, you know, it might be all right, you know, whether I've been hurt or wounded or anything, but quite clear in my head about that. Otherwise it was a dreary life there, in and out of the trenches, and you couldn't enjoy yourself really, there's to enjoy yourself too. You'd go to the canteens at night when you were out, they tried to make the best of it, you know, the Salvation Army and the other canteens there. Tea and coffee, or coffee mostly, and things, eats and chocolate and things like that. But otherwise, I shouldn't have been allowed. Well, yes, in the Second War, of course.
When you were wounded, you were actually buried.
I was buried. I got. And they cracked, it was a shoulder blaze, and I got this back all bruised, and I got ruptured, trying to get out, you see, as well. But my shoulders were pushed out, cracked, and my back, and same with this other chap, I forget his name, Fred, I think. But poor devil, I could hear him shouting, you know, get me out, but we were all covered up to our shoulders, I mean, and I tried to get my arms out, and we got mad, and then after he'd sent these three or four shells over, we thought he'd be quiet. The other chaps came along and then just dug us out a bit, you see. But, I was in Bromley there from November to April. That was the best time in my one of the best times of my army life. That was afterwards. After got operated on by a young doctor, a very good Dr. Paul. He came down from London. It was only a small hospital there. They were expecting some do in France. You know, they were sending all the smaller hospitals, getting them ready. And we, I saw suppose there were only about 30 to 40 beds there in this. So it was. I'm trying to think whether it was the Masons' headquarters or the Conservative Club. It was a very big house down at Bromley, turned into a hospital, you know.
When you were in France, did you see any women then?
A popper inch. As I say, this it was marvellous. I mean, I was trying to reckon how many miles up. It was one of the finest roads I've come across from Popper Inch to Ypres, or vice versa. Popular trees on either side. It was miles long. But they didn't seem to have been knocked about at all. There was one or two girls there. At Amiens, they didn't seem to have had any much trouble. They were knocked about a bit. Didn't seem to be anywhere. We went into the shops. Some of the shops were still there, you know. First time I had fish and chips was there in Amiens, in France. Le Havre, when we went over, we went to Le Havre, and you were allowed to go into Le Havre, you know, once or twice. But we were only there a week or most, fortnight at the most. We stayed waiting for orders to go up. So you were able to, but still you couldn't spend much. We were only getting bob a day, 7 bob a week. You couldn't do much. But that's the only time you saw the ladies at all.
And did any soldiers visit the red light districts?
I did myself once or twice. I think we all did. I mean, you go into these places. I mean, you didn't bother me much. You went in just for the sing song and wine. You see, you had either wine or coffee. There was no beer or anything. Just wine, vin blanc, as we used to call it, and coffee. These places, but. One thing I always admired there, which I think they should have done in England, and it was to license these places. They were well kept and looked after, you know. Not many chaps got into trouble, you know, to get to veneer or anything, trouble going to these places. It's where they were outside, some of the girls there who got outside that offering, that's where the trouble some saw them go. But in those places they were quite safe because they were inspected every week or a fortnight by doctors. And they always told us then, well, if you want a bit of fun, go to these licensed places. Rue de Mar and the one road was full of them, you know. But they were all licensed and well looked after.
Were they good value though?
Well, it cost us about 5 francs, I think. Yes. Just we couldn't have much more there. Yes, not too bad. Because I was young, we were all young then. No responsibility, nobody to worry about. It was nice to have a night out. But as I say, you couldn't have many nights out on 7 bob a week. And if you lost your spoon or your fork, it docked 6 months off your pay. But I didn't. I'm glad I went through it, mind you. I wouldn't like to have been like some people, you know, gone and gone through it all right. And. I wouldn't have had a guilty conscience. Especially when my brothers joined up and Dad wrote and said, oh, it'll be over in 4 months. Of course, everybody was saying it was going to be over in 4 months. You know, it wouldn't last long. It lasted 4 years and all the same as the other one.
And did your brothers come back all right?
No. Oh, one did. Yes, he died 3 or 4 years ago. I saw him No, my first one, brother, as I say, they got him, a couple of my cousins, then got buried there. The Germans had, Jerry had undermined the trenches and they blew it up, you know. And he was only about 19. But my second brother, he went up, young devil, he tried to get through when he was 16, you know. He was one of these scared. He didn't care damn for anybody. And they sent him home and said, come back when you're 17, we can see what we can do for you. And he went back when he was 17, but they didn't send him across. They kept him in the camp down there, you know, doing all odd jobs. And he was wounded in his ankle there. And walked with a limp for a long time. All of them, pretty well, nearly all his life. But
what was your other brother in? The one who was killed?
Well, he was in the beds and hearts of beds, Bedford's and Hearts Regiment. And I've got two cousins, or three cousins in that. That they very unfortunate, very early, you see, in the war, they hadn't started all that long, really, but they've got underground bomb blown up, and the young brother here, young Bert, as they call him, he didn't care a devil, and he came right. He still had a bit of a limp when he was walking, you know.
What, looking back on it, what was the most gruesome thing that you ever saw? Most horrific?
Well, as I say, towards the end, and this last shell that came just passed me and went in there. And I went, and there was another chap in the next bay, as we called it. We had the bays, you know, to stand in, stand to. And I went into him, I put the wind up me, and I rushed into his bay next, only a few yards away. And he was just as well as me, you know. Because we'd both been in the army some time, and even so, I said, "Look, I said, come on, we better go and see what we can do." I said, "But we couldn't do a damn thing; they were all in pieces." Went straight through because there was only iron top or side, you know, one proper dugout sort of thing, as we called it. Never was in the from our point of view, from our side, they never made proper dugouts. You got to tin iron and dough and dirt on top and pieces of wood to keep it together inside. It was just a question of shelter, you know. That was the worst. I did see one or two cases where I think the chaps had got a bit out of hand, or, you know, shouldn't have hurt, they shouldn't have been hurt, but trying to be clever in front of the German line, and got wounded, and then one of them got his arm knocked off, more or less, you know, things like that. You know, none of the police come across them. I was in hospital across the, there was a Scotch chap who was in hospital. He got his left leg, yes, I think it was his left, he got his left leg shut off, you know. Things like that, but some of those cases must have been very terrible, terrible, when they've gone over their top, you know, and been killed right and left, and wounded, and waiting for ambulances to pick them up. I say, I was very lucky, like our company were, after the, I think it was Hill 6, must have been Hill 60, because we went to fill up the numbers. We never went over the top. Very lucky that way. The others, some of the others went over, but we were stuck up. Fortunately, we were stuck up at Ypres all the time. regarding that particular section, you know. And no, I wouldn't like to boast about it went over the top or anything. No. There's nothing left deep in your own trenches.
Did you ever have to defend your trenches at all?
Pardon?
Did you ever have to defend your trenches from attack?
Oh yes, you were all ready. Ready, you, as I say, you'd only have your rifle and your bayonet and that sort of thing, but if they got any inkling, I mean, you very often get an inkling that the summit's going to happen, you might too. They'd bombard if they were going to do anything serious, they'd bombard for a few hours, you see, and shell in the place, shell in your lines, and that sort of thing. We did the same, and perhaps they do it sometimes. We've shelled their lines and given them an idea to think we were going to over the top there, but they'd be going over the top of somewhere else, you see, not far away, perhaps a mile or two away, but no.
So did you have to shoot any Germans?
I think I shot at one. I don't know whether I missed him or not. No. Oh, no. They got a bit, just this particular time, two or three of them, they were getting over and then. Because we weren't allowed to shoot just as we liked, you know, unless you were going over the top, of course, and didn't. Because I couldn't understand why we couldn't shoot at the, what aeroplanes we had on either side. You only had a few, one or two. But they were only flying at about 2,000 feet up. The planes going, and I mean, when one day we were moving from one place and we pulled up, and the transport crowd there were there, they got restrained. A few huts had been put up, you know, for the night traveling, and side of the road, and there was 12 horses along there. I can always remember this is one of the occasions, and they stayed there for night. Well, it wasn't quite dark, but we could see it, and this chap came over with his plane, and they were just throwing it, because they're on two occasions I saw this, they had no proper bombs. They were hand grenades, as we used to call them. And I'd say this on one occasion, in the daylight, he threw his hand grenade, I suppose, but over the side there, you know. Well, our chaps were doing the same, because we had no proper bombing arrangements in those days. They came and just threw them over the side. And then on this particular time, it wasn't dark properly. This chap did the side, and he threw them at this row of horses who was having their staying the night and having their food. And half of them were killed for, you know, knocking each other and killed. And, funny that. As I say, we never had not like during the Second World War, of course. We never see an aeroplane some days, for days on end, we never saw one. Then they were just over our lines, just keeping up. And then the observation balloons, that was another thing we couldn't fathom. Jerry used them more than we did. There was big balloons and the observation chap in them. When they were near enough to us, you know, to keep just behind their lines. And why we allowed them to stay up all day, taking advantage and knowing and watching what our people do now, transport coming up on the main roads. They marvelled to us why they weren't allowed to shoot at them or get them down, you know. But I don't. Same as us, they didn't shoot any of ours down, of course. That's the only proper observation they had, actually, really. Mm. But,
didn't you want to see a sentry shoot an officer?
Well, I shouldn't have done too much in the office. I didn't see it. I didn't know anything about it until about 18 months after I got wounded. This happened after I got wounded. And I came away, and about 18 months afterwards, I met some of the chaps who was with us, and they were up again, you know, being all, and they were telling me about it. There's some chaps from Manchester, they were a good crowd, they were. And they threatened then to happen to get me into trouble, because we had been on this observation post in the front of, in between the two trenches. I was unpaid arms corporal. And we'd done our duty, as we said, two nights. Well, when it was like that, we always reckoned we'd come home and come back and get into the trenches. Another lot took our place. And we were finished. We could go into our, wherever it was, if there was a little dugout or anything, and get down to a night's sleep. But somehow or the other, there was no ration to come up for the other, for the troops the next morning, you see. And the sergeant, this particular sergeant, he fetched me out. He says, better go and get your boys out and go down and get the rations up from headquarters. Two or three of them wouldn't come. I was in the action. And two of them got down there, said, we're not coming. He should have said. And he reported to me that to say that I wasn't doing my duty, you see. Anyway, I got into trouble up before the officer. I had detention there for so long. This was just before I got wounded, about two or three days before I got wounded, this was. And I never did a day of that. This detention was all down in black and white now. But these chaps said, we'll get our own back on them. There was this sergeant, Williamson, I think his name was, or something like that. But he was under butler, or what are these, we used to call them then, at a big house right on the seashore in Norfolk. There's a funny thing about these two. He was there at Norfolk, and as officer, he was a schoolmaster up in Northumberland, right on the edge of the coast, both of them. And they were very, very thick together. We always saw there was something radically wrong anyway. Anyway, I didn't do a day of my detention or anything, because fortunately I had the sergeant majors behind me. They didn't like them. And then when I got over my illness, over this wounding business, reported back to the headquarters, and they had me, the officer, had to go up before the officer. He said, I see that you're in a bit of a trouble or something or other. You said, I said, yes. Well, he says, as long as you behave yourself, you'll hear no more. I never heard a day. I didn't do a day of what I was supposed to do, and I never heard any more about it after that. But I heard that these two were in a communication trench where they shouldn't have been, and when they were challenged by the guards, they wouldn't answer because their chaps just stopped them. And they thought they were Germans, you see, coming through. Mm. But I don't know whether it was correct. It was about 18 months after I got back to the company. Mind you, it was done a lot. Mm. One or two big men's sons didn't go home, but they weren't killed by the Germans. Some of them too big a heads, and thinking, you know, my dad's this and my father's this, and they can do as they like, but they didn't. Here's some news about the sergeants, though, when the sergeants, when we were out of camp, you know, cleaning up, and they would also do this, you know, so no authority. But the day we went up towards the trenches, going in the trenches, though, they were just, you know, very different. All right, let's have a look.